I don't know how to play, and I don't want to anyway. Need to delete this game and go back to another save. But my hard drive's fucked. Zero charisma, zero luck. I don't have any skills or the XP to fix my
Hello and welcome to the 16th episode of the National Institute for Gamer Review. I am DK.
And I'm Lewis, and I am panic buying because the space truckers couldn't make it in time to my store.
Yes, and today we are discussing the space simulator genre, which is a kind of wide and far-ranging genre. I've been a fan of this. I mean, I don't know. It's captured my imagination from the time I was quite young, and space generally has captured my imagination from the time I was quite young. I think these things are related. It's you know, we were discussing before the show if we wanted to, like, you know, how kind of autistic we wanted to be. You know, as our show, the motto is, you know, for a more just, sane, and autistic world. But but there are limits to autism, and you know, I don't know that it's necessarily worth getting into the nitty gritty of, like, all of the different subgenres and you know, sort of things like that. I think, broadly speaking, these games are similar enough that that, you know, we can kind of discuss them all at once, and as always, you know, we reserve the right to sort of circle back and discuss you know, things again, and you know, in more detail, bring on a guest, whatever. But yeah, we thought this was a good time to talk about this genre because Elite Dangerous, one of the landmarks in the series, and a recent landmark, which is important because the genre was kind of dead for a long time. I was very, very sad through, like, the most of the 2000s into the 2010s that it seemed like a dead genre. And there were several projects that I followed actually with some interest that seemed, you know, that they were sort of independent projects that aimed at resuscitating the genre, but for whatever reason or reasons, it was kind of dead for a good about 15 years there. But then it came roaring back with first the ongoing disaster that is Star Citizen, and we can maybe just talk about that in a little bit. And do you have something you wanted to jump in on Star Citizen?
Yeah, I would want to just, I guess, say, we kind of mentioned some subgenres. I think broadly we can kind of lay it out as there's first person and third person, and then there's, like, war and peace.
I like that. Yeah, that's a good way to think about it.
If you're
going to
do the political chart, one axis is war versus peace, the other action is third versus first person.
Definitely. Although, and,
and I, which brings a question that you might know. What do you think is the first non-combat space sim?
Well, I guess it kind of depends on your... I mean, I'm unaware of... like, I guess it depends on your definition, or, like, what even is, you know, a space simulator. I mean, it's sort of a very broad... I mean, I guess, you know, to sort of speak about it in general terms, the it's a flight simulator where, rather than the simulation model... take, you know, the flight simulation, the whatever, the you know, the aeronautic simulation taking place in an atmosphere and modeling you know, things like the lift and drag, the simulation is taking place in, at least aesthetically, nominally, and we could talk about that more in a second too, because the in atmosphere less zero gravity environment. Now that really needs a big asterisk on it. Because going all the way back to really the invention, particularly of the space combat simulator, which was basically the invented with the first X-Wing game in 1992. The first Elite game came out in 1984, but it was sort of like, it was kind of, I guess, in the big brain centrist between the War and Peace thing. Like, there was combat. And it was, you know, important, but it was, you could also basically play it as a space trucker simulator. As far as, like, purely non-combat games, the thing that I found as far as this is 1983's Space Shuttle: A Journey into Space, which was published for the Atari 2600. I have never played this. I can't speak at all to anything about it. I will say that there's a little tidbit from an April 1984 review from Video Games Magazine. Quote, Space Shuttle is not a game for everybody. It requires a considerable amount of patience and, perhaps not too surprisingly, a considerable amount of brain power. Players who seek the visceral thrills of the standard shoot 'em up may ultimately find this simulation's complexity frustrating. But those of you who are ready for a richer, more sophisticated experience will probably recognize Space Shuttle for the monumental achievement it is. I'd be curious, and apparently I see there's an MSX version, maybe playing that on a ZX Spectrum or MSX. Emulator, I think could be interesting just to sort of see what it's about. I think this also raises an interesting question of, like, you know, some, for example, Kerbal Space Program. Like, is Kerbal Space Program a space simulator? Kind of arguably in some ways,
it's
right?
Third person.
You know? Yeah, right.
I would argue. Okay, I have a hot take on Kerbal Space Simulator.
Yeah.
It's not a space simulator because it actually accurately models everything physically. Well,
exactly, and that's what I was getting at. Yes,
a cornerstone of the genre is kind of fudging it.
Not just kind of, like, really. And yeah. That's what I was getting at before about, like, you know, nominally you're taking place in a zero G environment. The thing is, like, space. You know, when you're in a functional or whatever microgravity environment, there's no such thing as zero gravity, technically speaking. When you're in a microgravity environment, everything operates on more or less purely Newtonian principles, unless you start getting to relativistic speeds, which is a completely different thing. And obviously, you know, space games just completely, you know, oh, and then faster than light drive, you know, hand wave. But in terms of, like, if you're not, you know, quote, in hyperspace or traveling faster than light, one of the things that sets games in this genre apart from each other to some extent often is sort of how Newtonian the flight model is, and the answer is almost always, like, hardly to not at all is sort of the spectrum.
Yeah, I remember playing Elite Dangerous and I was amazed at how accurate and real a lot of it was. It's Elite Dangerous is excellent. It probably is the you know, best in breed right now, obviously.
Definitely.
But hands down. I was like, how do you slow down? Oh, you just use the engine less.
Right. Well, okay.
That's
so
not quite right.
No, it's not right at all. It's not right at all. But I will, to Elite's credit, they do include a kind of, like, you can turn that off. Now it's like, basically, they're like, Elite's interesting because, or Elite Dangerous is interesting because the flight model is, like, you basically, it's by default. Yeah, you reduce your thrust on your engines and you'll slow down, which is, like, the opposite of how it works in real life, in a microgravity environment. But you can disable that setting and you can have a more kind of pure Newtonian environment. It still fudges certain things to some extent, but actually, if you, because I haven't played Elite in a while. Part of the reason why I don't know if I mentioned this at the episode start, but as of this recording, sort of today or yesterday, they just dropped a new expansion pack for Elite Dangerous, which I'm probably the excuse I need to get back into it. I really enjoyed Elite Dangerous, and yeah, I think that definitely in my experience, when you're in a combat situation, there are clear advantages to disabling the Newtonian fudge, anti-Newtonian fudging, because then you can do things like you know, use your side thrusters to spin around while you're still traveling. So you're traveling, essentially. You can reverse or do all kinds of complicated, you know, maneuvers that are more or less the kinds of things that you would do in a quote, if it were like a real world type thing. Again, putting an asterisk on the question of, like, when we have, assuming we ever get off this rock and there is any of this kind of stuff actually materializes, or, you know, what would combat in a space environment look like? Are there going to be human pilots piloting craft that are more or less analogous to 20th century single-seater fighter airplanes? Probably not. Probably it's going to be even more drone-oriented than things are now. But that's, you know, again, it's sort of an interesting... it's sort of an interesting genre in that way as well, right? Is sort of it's a science fantasy projection of typically kind of mid 20th century ideas about space, is kind of just an extrapolation from the state of aviation as it existed at that time. And you see that explicitly in actually what we mentioned, X-Wing, which really founded the space combat kind of subgenre, where it's you're essentially exclusively focused on combat. There is no economic modeling. There is no, you know, trading or traveling, really. You're just kind of, you know, in a combat zone, out of a combat zone.
Also, what I think makes the like the early combat, what it didn't stand out from, say, a traditional or of the era, you know, real, quote unquote, flight shooter, is that they, I think kind of what defines the genre is how is the fudging of the Newtonian stuff. When they became, they basically become like an easier, more approachable fighter pilot, where there's no like ground to worry about. You're not landing on carriers and blowing up like you do in certain Top Gun games, notoriously so. There's a lot, you know. They basically, it's basically about approachability, and of course, Isaac, being Star Wars and stuff, gets tacked onto the back end. But it's easier to play a space shooter than almost every other kind of flight game, because you're not constantly banging into the ground until you get the hang of it. You know, you kind of can just immediately get the hang of it and have a good time.
Yeah, and that was definitely my experience. I mean, it gripped me from, you know, obviously the Star Wars license was very helpful in you know, capturing imagination of young DK. But yeah, I mean, it grabs you and dumps you in the action pretty much right away. And as I was saying, on that note, the developers, the people who made the game were they already had experience making World War II air combat simulators. Designer Lawrence Holland in particular, and you know that goes all the way back to George Lucas himself. I mean, has talked in interviews about how very self-consciously part of what he was doing in the space combat sequences in the original Star Wars film were based on, you know, World War II era pictures that he had seen and enjoyed as a child.
Well, you remember the this is kind of getting like deep, terrible Star Wars lore that I'm sure we've locked away.
Yeah.
That the original cut that he showed Spielberg was so the Death Star run was the last part to be, you know, finally finished by Industrial Light and Magic, and so that he had like a working cut where he had just stitched in World War II fighter pilot movies.
Yeah.
And made it work, like, because I think because it wasn't based off like what is it. Is it the Dam Busters or Where Eagles Fly, where they're blowing up the dam?
That and yeah, I think I'm not sure. I know another big influence is
they had played in that
footage
in
sure.
order to make the scene work. Yeah,
I know 12 O'Clock High was another big influence on him cinematographically.
Yeah, but so yeah. One of the cut, there's a cut of Star Wars or the original Star out there that instead of X-Wings, it's literally like Messerschmitts and, you know, Mustangs and stuff, which is in Spitfires, which is hilarious. I would love to see, honestly, for the, you know, but
yeah,
I'm sure definitely. It's long gone, you know, and but
yeah, that would be funny if we could track down the vault somewhere, wherever they store the original cuts. So we might, and while you're at it, make us a 4K edition without any of your gay shit you added later. But anyway, yeah. So it's basically. You know, the complexity comes from completely sort of invented, you know, fantastical elements that have nothing to do with, like, you know, actual real world aeronautics, and the flight model itself is, yeah, basically you're flying without having to worry about stalling, and you know, one of the most hilarious things which persists, I guess I'm outing myself a little bit here, but that's fine. Even into the Fantasy Flight Star Wars Armada tabletop miniatures game, kind of hilariously has the X-Wing game as well. They like do this thing where basically the slower that your giant space capital ship is moving, the faster it can turn, which like that makes sense in broadly speaking. In a terrestrial environment where you're maneuvering in an atmosphere, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever in in a space simulator, you know, in terms of Newtonian physics. So, I just found that funny that kind of thing about, you know, you got to slow down to turn fast. And that persists all the way to, there was a, while we're on the topic of X-Wing and the Star Wars space simulators, the most recent title, the, what was it? What is the actual, there's a new X-Wing,
movies?
But no, the
Star Wars
Squadrons. Squadron? They're not calling it an X-Wing, Squadron. Squadrons is pretty good. You know, it kind of came out of nowhere. They weren't like, it didn't have a whole lot of fanfare, but it's a faster paced take on the old X-Wing and TIE Fighter games. And interestingly, for a kind of mass audience that, you know, the closest thing they had to an experience of that was the space combat sections, I think, in Star Wars Battlefront. They
Which
even
are
put
excellent,
it,
by the way.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of fun. And that's the other thing, I guess, is sort of like, you know, suspension of disbelief is real. And, you know, like, there's nothing, I mean, even to the extent, I don't know if realism is a word I would use, but you know, the complexity in something approximating a flight model in the old X-Wing and TIE Fighter games, you know, like the 90s games for MS-DOS and then Windows, you know, when you strip all of that away and you take it out of the first-person cockpit and you do the third-person bit in, like, Rogue Squadron, like, Rogue Squadron was fuck-ton of fun. And all the Rogue Squadron games were a lot of fun. And, yeah, I mean... it doesn't. They're really dumb. Like, there's no. There's zero, you're not even really manned. I mean, you have like a basic health thing, base. You know, throttle and weapons, and that's kind of it. But you know, it's so cinematic, you kind of almost don't care. Or at least I didn't. You know, at the time, I'm sure anyone who's played them had a similar experience. And yeah. So when you have a similar kind, basically, I guess the Battlefront sections were essentially Rogue Squadron. Multiplayer, and now we have this Star Wars Squadron, which is kind of like a. But I will say though, I mean, it's definitely enjoyable, and I had a good time a little bit. I played with it, but at the end of the day, it mostly just made me want to go play the older games that were, you know, a little bit not quite as fast paced, not quite as, you know, first person shootery, a little bit more kind of like a actual simulation. In certain ways, or I don't know if it actually, again, it's sort of a question of like, what does a simulation even mean in this context? But I guess things that, you know, that the action takes place a little slower, the gameplay loop is designed a little bit more around managing subsystems, you have time to react. Basically, maybe we want to go play Free Space, which we'll talk about maybe in a second. Free Space 2.
Well, I do want to talk before we leave it, is how, because you talk about that there was kind of a hiatus from the genre of space sims. It was kind of hit on life support by things like the Battlefront series had their space combat, which is really funny because the Battlefront series it's kind of known for maybe probably until probably recently for my generation, it was like the defining Star Wars video game in a lot of ways, and the defining Star Wars space sim, because the TIE Fighter games are very old. You know, you're not really gonna be playing those if your first console is a PS2 or something like that, you know?
Yeah, of course not. So, no, I mean, did you what about Rogue Squadron? Or is that even a little too old?
That was even too old, yeah. But anyway, so one of the great things at the Battlefield system is that, or Battlefront system, is that the game, obviously it's a clone of Battlefield, and Battlefield kind of always has the choppers and airplanes all control the player fighting over the battlefield. So they also put in X-Wings and things that could fight over the battlefield and strafe and all this fun stuff, right? And in Battlefront 2, they had the system where two players could, in theory, dogfight, and they could do it pretty well, and they could lock on each other and all this stuff, because the planes could lock on to vehicles and each other. And they just pushed it into space and took away the floor. And the I guess you call it, terrestrial combat translated to meet because of the conventions of the genre. It's made it into a very, it's very good, it's a third person game, so it's not a true space sim, but the space battles in Battlefront 2 became a touchstone of, you know, what that, like that, when I think of a a fighter space game, I think of Battlefront 2 just because of the pure hours I've put into it. I put a lot of hours into Elite Dangerous, but it never quite feels as good because it's harder and more realistic. Of course, it's less arcade.
Yeah, I mean it's not but, exactly. It's not like a multiplayer shooter. You know,
the feeling of locking on to enemy fighter and shooting a missile at it, and then breaking off to go strafe the enemy capital ship, just feels really good in Battlefront, and it's almost kind of a complete fluke that it happened that way. It's just these systems worked, and they pushed them into another way of interacting, and it you know everything translated very well.
Yeah, I only played a little Battlefront. My Star Wars multiplayer experience was mostly Jedi Knight 2, which is like a whole other. I would almost put that in with the kind of we keep teasing Quake episodes, and definitely we'll do one. But that's very much a product. I even think it was running on a version of the Quake 2 engine. Don't hold me to that. But I believe it was, or maybe the Quake 3 engine. Anyway.
Do you want to do the hot take that all video games are actually just Quake mods?
Absolutely. No, that's like unironically true, though. Yeah, like that's from the era of GameSpy and custom servers, private servers, and you could just like, you know, it was just a completely different thing, and you could, you know, if you found a server and people would log on and you kind of like knew the regulars and it load up different playlists, and now of course everything is centralized and none of that exists anymore, and it's all very gay and dumb and worse, like everything else in Piss Earth. But anyway, yeah, so that's fun. That's funny about Battlefront, yeah, that they made it work, and definitely the I mean, I was surprised. So one of the key things that X-Wing introduced that was extremely influential for the genre was this idea of like you, which I guess is kind of, I don't know if realistic is the right word, but sort of intuitively corresponds to what we would expect, which is that, you know, your power plant produces a certain amount of power, and then it's up to you to sort of say, okay, well, where do I want this power to go? And the kind of broad breakdown is you can put more power in the engines, more power in your shields, or more power in your weapons, in lasers in particular.
Yeah. It's kind of the Star Trek model of ship command, right?
Exactly.
All
yeah.
power to the engines, all power to the shields, all power to the, you know.
Right.
It makes intuitive sense, so it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, it works really well. It always just sort of felt right, and then you can further on depending on the precise. I mean, that was one of my favorite little details and things that I really enjoyed and still enjoy is depending on the precise model. Like some ships have you know, you can set your shields to front all four sides. Some are only, you know, front and back. They come with different maximum shield ratings, and you can even, you know, sort of depending on the game, specific game, you can sort of tweak it maybe in the hangar before the mission about like, you know, oh, I want to, you know, bump up my maximum shield rating at the maybe expense of whatever, you know, whatever else, and then even tweak it beyond, you know, because in the this is like, I mean, just to sort of show you how the design changes over time, in my opinion, for the worse. And in you know, talking about some of the discussions we've had on post with people discussing, you know, like what are the differences in these games and how have games changed over time. In the original X-Wing and TIE Fighter, and I believe also in the X-Wing versus TIE Fighter that came out on CD later, when the default was that you could, when you're shifting power around, you do it essentially one pip at a time out of like, you know, a maximum of, I forget, whatever, like 10 pips or so. Meaning like you're drawing power, you're putting power in one system at the expense of systems like incrementally. You have the option at any point, you know, to also just throw everything available into one of those subsystems if that's what you wanted to do, but you could also sort of, you know, do it more incrementally, and that was typically the better thing to do. In the new Star Wars Squadrons, it's all or nothing, basically. You can set balanced or priority to one of the subsystems. That's it. There is no incremental adjustment. And you know, it's also, again, faster pace. It's just a lot faster paced. So like,
it seems like there'd be no reason not to just go all power weapons.
It's well, I haven't I played some on release and not much since, but at least as of release was actually All Power Engines, which was typically what made the most sense. Yeah. Because you were just, maneuverability was kind of everything. I don't know how
The gameplay I had seen, it seemed like you were almost always shooting.
Yeah.
Often.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it depends. But anyway,
I haven't played it myself, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's definitely good. Maybe get it on sale if you know, if you have the time or whatever.
I'm not interest. Buying a new Star Wars product. I mean, like, it would have to be very cheap for me to buy a new Star Wars
product. Oh, well, yeah, that's the other thing is, like, I mean, at this point, that's a whole other conversation. But, yeah, like, the Star Wars, it would be interesting for culture terror discussion as far as, like, you know, because we want to handle both things we like and things we don't like. And I guess it's, you know, Star Wars maybe at this point is kind of both. Yeah, like, you know, what has this? Yeah, it's like, do I even really want to support this thing at this point? That's a good.
What have I become? Great, yeah. It's like,
indeed, yeah, exactly.
Just cue the Johnny Cash and let's write, you know.
Yeah, write a obituary. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I actually never. I still haven't seen the last Star Wars movie. I like after just the total contempt for me and anyone.
Speaking of Newtonian,
why do you say that?
that second to last new Star Wars movie had some real.
Oh my God! Yeah, well, that was about to say about like the whatever they call the second to last one. Like, it was such an insult. It was just like they're rubbing it in the face of like anyone who cared about the franchise like prior to the introduction of all their gay bullshit, like. They're like, aha, fuck you. And I'm like, okay, fine. Then, you know, I can take my ball and go home. I'm not a Reddit guy. Like, I understand there's some Reddit people who, like, you know, it says, the brand thing says Star Wars on the label, and therefore they must consume. You know, that hasn't applied to me in quite some time. You know, really almost never, frankly. So, like, fine.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can have it.
I mean, anyway. They had me, even though I was, like, fully red-pilled for the first new one. I was like, all right, let's do this.
Yeah, I wanted to see what it was about. And I will say, you know, The Force Awakens wasn't good, but it wasn't, like, terrible, and nor was it an insult, you know?
What destroyed it for me was there was a great... we're going into Star Wars. We're posting. We should
wrap it up. It's fine. It's good for the... It's relevant for the... Yeah.
The genre is, like, the Star Wars genre. The genre is kind of inseparable from Star Wars.
Yes, yes, yes. That's a great keep. Yes. Even, like, I loved... Maybe one of my favorite games of all time is Free Space 2, which I mentioned before, and maybe this is a good time to segue, but I just, on that note, like, I loved Free Space, both the original and the sequel especially. The main thing that I loved about it, like, the story was interesting, and you know, it had a cool, it was kind of like an interest, it had interesting stuff going on. But the thing, the number one appeal, the most appealing aspect was that it took the X-Wing formula and it just made it perfect. It made everything feel right. It made, you know, issue squad commands intuitively, you know, balancing your systems intuitively, the heads-up display, everything was like, it was made by people very obviously who, like, played the shit out of the original X-Wing and TIE Fighter, loved it, but saw the kind of, you know, failings in the UI and certain kind of things like that, and just made it perfectly refined. Like, this is the definitive experience of a space combat simulator. And I haven't really seen, I mean, I know, you know, we talked about Elite Dangerous. Elite Dangerous, the combat is okay. You know, it's not, like...
It's not the focus at all.
Elite Dangerous is an exploration game. You know, it's kind of almost more like this
trucking, right?
You can do trucking, but the trucking simulator is the X series. It's almost more of like a Star Trek simulator. Like, that's my hot take on Elite Dangerous is a Star Trek game, not a Star Wars game.
I need to get back into Elite Dangerous because when I played it, it's still doing the galaxy is massive and huge.
Yes.
But I would, like, you. When I was playing it, I don't know if it's still the case, if you ran in one direction for, an hour or two at the top speed, every planet would be named, like, a series of numbers and asterisks.
Oh, it's the same, yeah. Well, I don't know. Really? Some stuff has been, well, because it's procedurally generated. I mean, known space, they did handmade content for the Earth, you know, Sol system.
Really,
and for some stuff,
there was no known space. It was just like
Yeah, they did some stuff that's like actual, but mostly it's just procedurally generated. And yeah. I know, I think they've changed. I haven't, that was my thing, was like, I, you know, grinded my way up to an Asp Explorer and then did a little exploring and kind of almost felt like, you know, it was, I had done enough and haven't really played too much since. I would love to, I think one possible thing we could do is I could, you know, we could play the new expansion and then reconvene and discuss that at some point once we had a chance to digest it. But yeah, it's a little bit, it was always, I think they've done a good job of sort of filling it out some, but it definitely felt a little bit empty, a little bit cold and lifeless.
That's why I kind of played as like a trucker, because the trucker thing made more sense.
Yes.
In terms of what was there, in terms of the bones of the game.
Right.
You know, doing runs of this material to this base, maybe.
Yes, definitely. Myself as well, yeah. And then I got to, like, that was the thing, is you sort of, like, set an arbitrary goal yourself, like, oh, I've accumulated this much capital, and sort of like, okay, well, that's enough of the loop for now. You know, I'll come back later when you maybe have a little more content. But, yeah, so, and I think, from what I understand now, they're basically, with the new expansion, that is for the first time you can get out of your ship, they're letting people the first person to set foot on a new world gets to name it or something.
Ah,
so,
oh god. Oh no.
I don't know how that. Yeah, I'd be curious.
So we're getting back into Elite Dangerous.
Yes.
And
spreading windmills of friendship across the galaxy.
Oh.
Yeah.
Who hung after Nuremberg's getting a planet? So help me God.
Yes, Commander Julius Streicher. I have to change my name in game. Anyway, so while we're on the topic of I guess more modern stuff, do you have any history at all or any experience with Star Citizen?
So I have always enjoyed following. I never played it. The Eve franchise.
And oh yeah, same. I think a lot of people. I think more people sort of enjoy reading about Eve than actually play it. Yeah, that's definitely me.
So I took that same spirit to Star Citizen, and reading about that is so much. It's not as good in terms of like the machinations, the quality, but in terms of like a human drama. Like, you think Dogecoin is like a bunch of people wondering if they're fucked or not fucked, or are we going to be all rich, or is this a good or bad thing? Star Citizen is a level of, like, it's a cope-a-thon, it's like an investment property. It's like basically there's like a cryptocurrency element to that stuff, where there's like finite amounts of ships and things in the community, and they can command
value. The ships are literally NFTs.
Yeah, it's like there's probably money laundering going on at some point.
Oh, no, there's definitely money.
Like, Star Citizen, like, so Star, so Eve is gonna end with, that Eve's never gonna end, but at some point, someone might get murdered over Eve. Maybe.
I think people have gone to jail, or, like, there's definitely been, like, real world, no, like, I'm saying, yeah.
Eve ends in people in jail.
Yes.
Not Eve, sorry, Star Citizen ends with a lot of people involved that don't think they can go into jail.
Yes. Yes,
or being murdered by the, or
like, yeah, whatever, the fan base, like showing up at, yeah, like, Chris Roberts' house.
You
with,
thought,
yeah.
What was the speaking of space sims? What was the planet procedural generation game that was a big flop?
Oh, No Man's Sky.
No Man's Sky. You thought No Man's Sky was weird? No Man's Sky. It's gonna look like a joke when Elite Dangerous never comes. Whenever like the final version is announced, which is funny because they can never release a final version.
So there's actually, okay. So I actually followed this the Star Citizen saga with some level of detail because.
Oh, I get the newsletter.
Oh wow, really? No, I don't. I follow it from Derek Smart's. Do you know Derek Smart?
No, I get the official. Well, I follow
that's
the official
funny.
Company. Like, I follow,
okay,
like,
yeah.
the
propaganda press releases. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's great. Yeah,
I'm sure it is.
It's the same way I watch Iranian media. You can't watch American media. You have to watch what the Iranians say.
Right, right.
About Iran. Yeah, it's the exact same thing.
That's funny. Okay, so Derek Smart. I mean, this is like I don't want to spin this out too far. Derek Smart is a solo developer who is just a kind of interesting guy. He's been around online like since the 90s, since the, maybe even the 80s. He's been around forever. When I was but a wee lad, I tried and failed to play. He tried to do the Elite Dangerous thing like when it was not even really technically possible. He's a very smart guy, but he's like extraordinarily autistic. So he made this game, Battle Cruiser 3000 AD, which there's some, like, now when it was eventually released, it was sort of like he intended it to be a kind of the most advanced, most detailed, most quote realistic space simulator that had ever existed or really would ever exist. He had a publishing deal, I believe, with Take-Two, and then Take-Two got like tired of waiting for him to finish it and dealing with his autism, so they like forced him to release it prematurely, which was, I guess, the release that I played. Anyway, it was kind of a disaster, and he spent a long, decades kind of like dealing with the fallout from that. But he's still developing games, and he's still a very active contributor to the discussion about, in particular, space simulators. And so, like, when Star Citizen was announced, in, I think it was 2013 or something like that, it was 2012 even, maybe, my God, it's been like 9 years. So the developers,
I want to point out with Star Citizen, as time passes, the threshold the devs have to hit to not get murdered gets higher and higher, because if you released like a great game from 2013, they're all gonna get murdered by these people who spend millions of dollars. Like,
right.
Like,
yeah,
it's like a Ponzi scheme, but it, like, really, in terms of developer confidence.
Well, it's also just literally a Ponzi scheme. I mean, well, except for all the profits go to Chris Roberts.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful.
Who, like, so when I first heard word of this, I was like, oh my God, Chris Roberts is doing a new thing. Now, so Chris Roberts, for those of you who don't know, like we mentioned X-Wing, the other kind of big picture, space simulator game was of course, Wing Commander, which, I mean, there's a whole bunch of, like, I don't know. So Wing Commander, the original, was released in 1990. It was revolutionary. It was one of these, we've discussed, in the past. Now, I don't know how much of this is just him taking credit, but I do believe it was pretty much just Chris Roberts by himself, almost by himself. I guess, no, there were other programmers on staff. Okay, so it wasn't literally an entirely solo project, but it was mostly a solo project. And it's from the era of games where you had, one-man teams or very, very small teams that could execute on an, artist's vision, essentially. Then, I guess, like, the interesting thing is the number one legacy of Wing Commander was really in the combat simulation, which was I guess it beat X-Wing to the punch a little bit, but it was still, like, very much in that World War II in space type thing. The thing is, Chris Roberts was more interested in telling a story and in being a movie director. I guess, like, he always kind of considered video games as like a platform for him to eventually be a movie director. And indeed, there was eventually a Wing Commander movie with Freddie Prinze Jr., I believe. Was that right? Am I hallucinating this? I'm not hallucinating this. Do you ever see that? Were you aware of that?
I'm not. Are you thinking of?
No,
you're in 19, Last Starfighter.
No. There was a Wing Commander movie starring Freddie Prinze Jr., released in 1999, which had basically nothing to do with the very, very little to do with the film franchise. Sort of a very loosely adapted version of the story from Wing Commander 3, which was which was like the full. What, we talk about full motion video games and stuff like that. It's a there was a time before when computations, especially graphical computations, were still really, really expensive. Detailed graphical computations were really expensive, where it was cheaper and easier for studios to make, like, essentially movies, even hiring big name, movie stars to film than it would have been for them to make very detailed, like Pixar style 3D animations. this is where you get things like Mark Hamill in the cutscenes for Wing Commanders 3 and 4, and James Earl Jones in the cutscenes for Command and Conquer Tiberian Sun. Because you know it was a big budget studio productions, and it's sort of an interesting, you know, relic of a bygone era. Anyway, yeah, there was a Wing Commander movie. The most famous bit of this, or the only bit that really sticks out to me because it was just the most absurd, was like, because I guess he wanted to do like a World War II U-boat bit, so. So they have a bit where, like, we all have to stay very quiet because, like, their sonar is going to hear us. Like, yeah, because the sonar in space, you know, works really, really well with all those sound waves, you know, traversing the interstellar medium.
What is it? Das Space Boot.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, yeah, so he got Mark Hamill to do, there was like the cat aliens who were literally called the Kilrathi because it's like kill wrath and like Kilrathi. I mean, it's just like the whatever. Anyway, so there was the big bad aliens from 1, 2, 3, and then in 3 you like nuke their homeworld essentially. And then in 4, you know, there's a 4 was actually one of the first games that I played all the way through in the series. It like sticks out to me, like, I guess especially kind of post Red Pill, because it's a really, did you ever played it, or are you familiar with it at all, or Wing Commander 4?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so Wing Commander 4 is subtitled The Price of Freedom. It stars Mark Hamill and some other famous Malcolm McDowell is like the big bad guy, and essentially it's a story about, like, it's just called The Price of Freedom, and the tag is, because, you know, the saying, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Basically, there's like the pan-human alliance that united to defeat the Kilrathi is under strain. There's essentially like defections to a kind of space confederacy. They even call it the Confederacy. And the Admiral, like, essentially, it turns out that the game sort of forces you into the position that the good guys are the Confederates, because the Admiral is a fascist, because he, like, he's determined that in the absence of the Kilrathi, like, humans need some kind of, you know, enemy to fight against. And so he's like, you know, if we're not eternally vigilant in this particular way, then, you know, we're going to be defeated by the next big bad aliens. And I mean, there's like war crimes and shit that happens in the media, but it was sort of like, it's sort of like a weird, interesting relic of a politics from a completely different, like from the 90s, you know.
Yeah. I was actually gonna mention that you notice I don't want to say, like, give ourselves too much credit, but let's call it in the post awareness of them era, or this, you know, that fiction has stopped being about, like, space fiction is no longer about grand confederacies of humans and aliens, and now is generally science fiction is about pretty much solely about humans. A certain level of human chauvinism, I think. Except for Star Wars, obviously, kind of the last holdout. But I really can't remember the last kind of big gay alien confederacy or federation, whatever, in any kind of new fiction. It seems to be kind of absent from the
movie. No, on the contrary, it's all about, like, you know, we humans need to get with the program and accept, you know, the giant, bulging, pulsating alien space penis into our, you know,
human... No, I'm saying it's the opposite. I've noticed the opposite.
What do you mean? Sorry.
Like, I'm saying there's much fewer, like, confederations in modern video games and movies about space. We got, like, an Ender's Game movie about, like, genocide and aliens. We got, I guess the kind of the Halo has kind of always been, you know, kind of very, very human chauvinistic. Yeah, there's, like, obviously there are other aliens, but I haven't noticed a lot of, like, big confederate, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, the kind of cross-species confederation seems to have kind of faded with the post-2010. There's not too many of them that I can think of. it's outside of Star Wars, like Star Wars and movies and Star Trek, but those are just kind of, you know, inertia.
Yeah, no, I think we're saying the same thing, or maybe I'm still misunderstanding, but like that's what I mean is like there's no narrative of like humans having to do basically like the model for this, the narrative model for this is always the Persian Wars, right? Where it's like you have Greek city states kind of squabbling amongst themselves who are faced with this kind of existential foreign threat. So they need to get over their differences because really what unites them is much more, they have much more in common, you know, genetically, culturally, linguistically, religiously than, you know, than what separates them. And so they unite to defend off this foreign threat. That's kind of, I mean, I think that's always kind of hanging in the background of these kind of stories. And it's like deep in the Aryan blood consciousness memory, right? Now, of course, the coda to that story is the Peloponnesian War, but never mind that. Anyway, yeah. And you even see this, actually, I mentioned a little bit about Free Space. Like the kind of big picture story about Free Space is actually it's simplistic but not bad, and I there were things about it that I enjoy and I think would still enjoy is sort of like when Free Space starts, which is like its own, you know, franchise, the humans are locked, you're like in the middle of a fight, essentially race war with these aliens, the Vasudans, and it's like this is the, you know, as humanity expands, they encounter this other galactic civilization, and immediately obviously hostilities break out and you're just sort of dealing with that. Then this third party shows up, the Shivans, like the it's kind of interesting, like I guess a Hindu type thing. They're like, we're, you know, they don't Vasudans, there's some kind of communication that's possible with, and they're sort of vaguely humanoid. Shivans are totally alien and with extremely advanced technology that humans have absolutely neither humans nor Vasudans have any kind of ability to counteract. And so the humans and the Vasudans have to like work out their differences, and they reach this grand Terran Vasudan alliance. So at first you're fighting under the flag of the United Human whatever, and then from like midway in the first game all the way through the second game, you're fighting under the flag of the GTVA. And that's the whole thing, is like you have this extremely, you know, like this not even just like alien in the truest sense, and you can't even comprehend their motives. The cutscenes are actually interestingly sort of told from the Shivan perspective, and it's like this female voice that's kind of sounds somber and sad, and like we have to do this, and it's got cool stuff going on, but even that is fitting within this framework of, you know, like, yeah, humanity is locked in a race war, and it has to make its peace with even these kind of, you know, aliens that we were fighting against not so long ago, that are like less alien than this completely, you know, metaphysically alien force, this threat that we can't even, like, we have no ability to communicate with. They just seem totally bent on destruction. We don't understand their motives, but they whatever it is that they're doing, it's blowing up our ships and our planets. Anyway, yeah, that kind of a thing, those kinds of stories seem to have fallen, and that kind of a framework, narrative framework, seems to have fallen completely. Like, I guess the closest, I don't really play Destiny, but I guess there's sort of a similar vibe in Destiny. I don't really know. I don't think so, though. I mean, there's like some
Everyone
weird...
Everyone seems human, but like...
Yeah.
I don't know. The only thing I can think of was like Elite Dangerous, which is riffing off those old things, but also about a race war.
Well, I was going to say, but like even in Elite Dangerous...
The aliens join your crew are basically kind of janissaries.
Right.
Or like owe you a life debt. Like they're just right. Not part of your thing. They're just like in the crew.
But are the aliens... I mean, that's the interesting thing about Elite Dangerous is like, because you have these, you know, the human factions. Like, it's... I don't think that...
Say if you're Elite Dangerous?
Maybe I'm
I meant
not...
FTL.
You meant FTL. Okay, I was going to say, like, I don't think that... Yeah.
No, FTL is doing the kind of Federation bit. But
FTL is definitely more of a Star Trek game. I mean,
but you're traveling a galaxy in the middle of a six-way race war.
Yeah, right. Like, yes. Yes.
And
but
and
your main enemy is another human faction.
Yes, but like the ones that end up the aliens, you start off as humans, or usually you can unlock other things with the narrative is you're a human faction, and aliens can join your crew, but you like buy them as slaves, or they owe you a life debt, or you just hire them. Like, they're really not part of your ideological thing.
No, not at
they
all.
They just kind
Yeah, right. Because yeah, you're like, you're the what? You're the
and you go
legit
to like their like their nebula, and they immediately all want to jump you.
Yeah. You're the thing with FTL is you're what? You're the legitimate government, and there's an rebellion. It, interestingly, one of the few games.
Yeah.
I was gonna say like one of the very few games that are the rebels in FTL the white supremacist.
No, I thought but you were the white supremacist.
They're
all human. You're the Federation. You're the big gay Federation.
Wow. So then maybe it is like.
Oh no, it is. But you're like you're revealed as wrong the entire time. Like you spend the whole game being like, effectively proven wrong, because you
okay. This is a hot take because I'm unfamiliar with.
So the Federation is, you know, all the species under kind of one roof, right?
Yes.
But as soon as the Federation is like slightly out of power.
All the aliens are at each other's throat.
All the aliens are at each other's throat, and
so like it's a Tito simulator, and it's like you know Yugoslavia 1992.
Yeah, you're basically trying to keep things together, but like no one wants to help you. Those that help you are kind of like incidental to the whole thing.
I missed that context. I mean, I guess I played FTL only enough to beat the game, and then I was like,
"We're all
no." As you were saying that, I was remembering because, like, you know, I played against the final boss of FTL maybe half a dozen times, and only ever beat him once. And yeah, it's definitely I remember it's an entirely human crew because that like stuck out to me. The rebel flagship is crew is entirely human. I don't know if it's like explicit in the game lore.
It's not, but
it makes sense if you think about it. Like, why would they be rebelling? Oh, because they just want to have a thing for humans.
Yeah.
Like, right? Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, so would you consider FTL a space simulator? Like a third person?
So, it's not quite turn-based, but effectively is turn-based because of the way the time system works. Because you can play it in real time, but you're not gonna, it's the least effective way to play it. I think it is a space sim, but it's kind of, it's like the most, everything's kind of like, what would the phrase, it kind of combines Space Sim and Excel spreadsheet into one game, where you can just, instead of like, you know, actually physically maneuvering more power, or maneuvering to dodge, you can do certain things to make yourself less likely to be hit, instead of like, you know, everything is effectively like a number you punch in to achieve a result. Usually it's like about power or where you're going, or but it's not like it, I guess I can't call it a, you really can't call it a simulator. It's mostly like, it's more like a, it's a little bit of Pokemon than most like, than like a space sim. It's just kind of riffing on the themes and the systems by kind of abstracting them into kind of this kind of playable Excel spreadsheet. And then, but it's, I would say it's closer to Pokemon than like a space sim in terms of like the actual what you're doing. If that makes sense. Or I was it's Rogue. It's like Rogue.
Yeah, I mean, it's Rogue. Like, throw, I,
then it's
we,
like Pokemon.
Yeah.
But
and we'll have to do a Rogue-like or episode at some point. It's a, it was, I guess it's a little bit faded now, but it was for about 5 years there, all the rage was the Rogue-like subgenre, you know, sort of adopting kind of, you know, permadeath idea, or I guess I mean not even I mean the I, I'm one
well,
of the
I'm
few
just
yeah
it was the return of difficulty.
Yes. Dark Souls brought it back, and
difficulty was
yeah.
gone. Well, difficulty was for I would say
since Gamergate, like since those fucking faggots sorry
even before that it was falling off, like
yeah,
like I would say at the beginning, like I think games like God of War and Uncharted are very very easy, you know, they're great
yes.
games
yes
but they are just, you know, you they're not at all.
There's no challenge. That's true. Yeah.
And the point of where to get any kind of challenge in most modern games.
Well, that's
games,
the thing is like, well, because
in the hardest setting. The
so going back all the way to the old arcade games, it's like, I mean, even on the hardest, I guess, of course, there's always the hardest setting. You know, that's one way to do it. But like, I think really it has to do with hard drives, you know, or at least some kind of save state, because, you know, we discussed beat 'em ups. And something that beat 'em ups in the arcade games have in common, or with the kind of original arcade shooters like, you know, Space Invaders and Galaga and Centipede, is no continues really, and even if you have continues, you have to put in quarters, and even then, it's like there's no, you know, you sort of have on rails for a certain amount of time, And it, there's no, like, you know, difficulty comes from, you know, essentially, in some ways, the technical limitations of you're not able to save progress. And you see this especially on Nintendo and Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis era, you know, games like that where, you know, like, or, you know, even early Mario's where, you know, like the Super Mario Brothers, where, you know, you have a certain number of lives, and if you run out of lives, it's game over. You have to start the whole thing all over again. Once, and I mean, okay, you could say that that's design, and you could still design that, but that would piss everybody absolutely the fuck off. Like, nobody wants to deal with that, especially when it's no longer have to deal with any kind of technical limitations in terms of not being able to save progress because you don't have a hard drive, because everything has a hard
drive.
Also,
like, modern Mario has, like, what, 2,000 levels in it?
Yeah.
Like, the actual number of levels is...
It's absurd. At this point. Right, yeah. So, so you get... And then that's why I think also you see some, you know, something like speedrunning where, you know, the challenge then becomes essentially something self-imposed rather than necessarily, you know, and some designers will, you know, toss into that, yeah. Like, you know, you can increase your, you know, time or decrease your time or whatever, but for the most part, that's like a self-imposed thing.
There was definitely an era in the easy point of video games. I was playing one of the Call of Duties, and I was, like, disgusted at how easy the game was.
Mm.
So I was trying game setting, like, self-impositions on it, where it was like, okay, only pistols, and right. You can't die.
Yeah, right.
And you can recover a lot of fun that way with those modes. Halo has the hilarious and impossible, in my opinion. I'm sure, like, the all skulls legendary stuff. If you're willing to impose, you know, costs on yourself, you can make a lot of very easy games fun.
Yes, yes.
But. The rogue games, you know, making it hard. Intentionally, I think it was necessary. I think it did bring difficulty back in a lot of ways.
Well, I think it's here to stay. Well, you know, but, I mean, sorry, go on.
But I think also there's, you see, games are in absence of that, games are turning back towards easy. If my experience with modern.
Well, I think you sort of almost see a genre split of, like, there's hard games and then there's not, you know, easy games is almost like you could sort of make a first approximation.
Or maybe they could call it Japanese games and American games.
Yeah, there's a
I'm
lot
not
of truth.
Joking. I'm not even
there's
joking.
A lot of truth to that, absolutely. Well, I mean, Dark Souls, of course, is a Japanese game, and I mean, you don't necessarily need permadeath for a game to be hard, but it's noteworthy.
The difference between, like, say, when, so The Witcher is interesting because it's obviously the Polish series.
Yeah.
This first and second game are very, very hard. You can play them on easy, but they're very difficult games. You got to do all kinds of stuff.
Well, they say,
it's not an easy game, but it's not like what it
not
was,
as hard as
you know.
Well, the first one, I remember when you're creating a character and starting the game, they're like, you know, you set the difficulty, and it's basically like on all but the easiest setting. They're like, which is still not, like, you know, quote easy. There's sort of like, yeah, you could do whatever, but in the medium and hard, you know, normal and hard-ish difficulties, they're like, you have to use all the systems. You will have to craft potions.
You have to use potions, weapon upgrades, magic upgrades.
Yeah.
And they're all very dense systems.
Yes.
The new one isn't nearly as like that.
But anyway, and that, I guess, maybe takes us to, like, one of the long-standing frustrations with the genre, which I don't know, of space sims, which I guess there's some development on this score, but I think Elite Dangerous has really set the... Oh, we never finished talking about Star Citizen. We'll go back in a second. But which is you can't save in the middle of a mission. All the way up until very, very recently, there was, like, you know, engines did not allow for... Because it was just so complex.
There's too much going on.
Too much going on. Yeah. You can't save all the necessary information for the world.
Well, it is an easier version of a flight sim.
Yeah, it's still
a flight sim level of things happening.
Exactly. Right, so. And you can't just, like, you know, to save all that information, because saving and loading world states is, you know, if you don't, for some reason, know this, it's extremely... That's one of the hardest things an engine can do, to the point where a lot of... I don't believe that the CryEngine supports it out of the box. And I think that's true.
The new EA,
Frostbite. Frostbite didn't support it either. It supported very, very limited, which is why when they were making the new Dragon, one of the biggest problems they had with Dragon Age 3 and that they were having with Dragon Age 4 was getting Frostbite to save like world state information in a way that, like, a, you know, say what you will about the Bethesda games and the Elder Scrolls and Fallout first person games, but like, you know, they do, like, their engines are technically impressive, right? I mean, they definitely, like, are technological achievements, and being able to, like, keep track of insane amounts of non-player characters and world items and physics and all that kind of stuff is really quite impressive. And they had to design an engine specifically to do that. Most other engines, you know, engines have to be designed specifically to do that. And so, yeah, the interesting thing on that note is, as far as Elite Dangerous is concerned, is like it tends in an opposite kind of direction of like sort of stepping over that whole problem where, because you don't need, there's no, like, what do you need to save? You know, like if you like the main reason to save state and load state is if there's some kind of player, you know, fails the mission or dies. Well, in Elite Dangerous, you know, you fail a mission or you die, you just, you know, lose some credits and maybe some reputation points and move on. It's part of the simulation, part of the broader simulation, right? Not like the flight model, but the kind of economic and overarching thing. So that's one kind of design solution to that problem. Is what I want to say. Yeah. So Star Citizen, I wanted to go through. Yeah. It's Derek Smart was I mentioned before. He's been on top of this since like he donated to the campaign. Now when I saw the campaign in 2013, and I was like, okay, this is super interesting, but I'm not like, you know, this seems a little bit.
I don't want to brag, but I can't because you can't claim back catalog clout.
Yeah.
But I was like, there's no fucking way. There's no way.
I wasn't quite at the like there's no way thing. I was more like, I want to see where this, I don't want to, yeah. It seems like, you know, I want to see where this goes. I'm not going to like give money yet. Well, I want to see where it goes.
Burned so hard by the so it had a very similar fanfare and hype was the MMORPG for the Old Republic.
Oh, okay.
And They like the trailers were like looked like movies, you know, like it was insane, and there was such a little hype. Oh, you're gonna be able to go anywhere in the Star Wars universe, do anything, talk to anybody, blah blah blah.
And it didn't, yeah.
And it didn't do that. It was like, oh, it's just like a wow, but it's Star Wars, which is fine, but it's not what right. hyped to be.
I had and a I similar.
That's when I also realized. Oh, there are limitations on what you can do with a space
yes.
game
and
flying
and,
around.
Yes, and I and, had a very similar thing with, actually with Chris Roberts specifically, because I bought Free Space, Freelancer on release, which was like, so it was intended to be, it was one of, it was sort of like Star Citizen before there was Star Citizen, it was third person, and it was actually kind of it's a whole other clusterfuck from a preceding era, like three generations ago of video games where basically because Microsoft had bought, like, after the success of Wing Commander, Chris Roberts struck out on his own. He made a company called Digital Anvil, and he started developing Space Sims again. The first one, which was a kind of like, I actually enjoyed it. It's a very fun kind of blast 'em up called Star Lancer. It's like, you know, it was intended to be a kind of prequel thing to the other game that he was developing. He, I guess, lost interest and wasn't really able to do it anymore. So it ended up going to a third party studio, but released kind of under their umbrella. His big thing was Freelancer, which was sort of like, you know, again, sort of what the, you know, 4X, you know, like you this is space trucker slash combat slash thing. It had a very, very forgettable, very stupid story about some kind of alien thing. I don't remember. It was dumb. But it was mostly noteworthy because after just insane cost overruns and delays, and, you know, Microsoft at a certain point lost faith in Chris Roberts' ability to complete the project, so they cut him loose and released it themselves. I was still interested enough in the game that I just love space sims. I was like, okay, whatever, I'll play it. And it wasn't the worst. It was very clear what the, you know, problem was in terms of the scope just not working. Which is the main reason why. So it wasn't even just.
It's always funny when you can see the cut, when you can see the cuts in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that was sort of like, I was like, oh, I had a little bit of trepidation. I was like, okay, whatever, let's see where this goes. And then it was sometime in like 2014 or 2015, you know, they, Star Citizen was like, you know, kicking ass and looked like they were actually going to get something out the door. The Kickstarter was big and successful, and you know, they were expanding and they were, you know, releasing playable shit. And I was like, okay, well, you know, this is, you know, there were, whatever, I'll sync. Whatever, like, it was the most it was like $40 or something for the like the basic thing. I was like, okay, whatever, it's worth $40, I can refund later if I want to. A year passes, 2 years pass, 3 years pass. I'm like, okay, this is, and I was lucky because at a certain, I remember I was, it was because I was following Derek Smart, who also, and now he had spent, I believe, like several hundred dollars. He was like a big, not like the huge backers, because there are people, dude, I don't know if you know this, like basically the backer side of Star Citizen is kept afloat by people who have sunk literal thousands, in some cases tens of thousands of dollars into this game.
Oh no, it's hilarious. There are what, 50, there's like a $48,000 spaceship, right? Something's crazy.
I think the $30,000-$40,000 stuff is like packs. It's not one individual. The most expensive individual ship. Yeah, right. The most expensive individual ship is like $1,500, or at least it was as of like a year or two ago. Yeah. Which, like, I mean, hilariously, a lot of these things, like the he's selling JPEGs of ship designs that have no implementation in the game, for which the systems that, like, he's saying, like, oh, you can buy a $200 like mine layer ship. Well, there's no mine like space mining mechanics, like you know in the game yet. You know, like, oh, this is a hospital ship. Well, there's no like medical functionality
and
in
what
the
even
game.
Could there be,
right? Be like, what would it even exactly?
But I know why the best part is that, so it's, the Ponzi scheme works because everyone has this idea that it's gonna come out, and because I've spent $40,000 on the game, I will be the big top shit player, and I will be the coolest person in the room. The problem is those are the only kind of people left,
right?
So there will be no one to lord it over.
Nope.
So you will have to go murder someone.
Well, I think it's like there's definitely that dynamic, but I think even prior to that, it's like how to say. I think now, granted, I haven't played. You know, and I know some people are still into it, but like I haven't played in a long time. But I see the YouTube videos. It's like, this is extremely basic functionality. Like, half the stuff doesn't even work.
Walking around a ship.
Yeah. It's really not. It's just not implemented, and which sort of keeps up this illusion, because I think really what he's selling, what Chris Roberts is selling with Star Citizen, is a fantasy. It's in the literal sense of like, it's literally like everybody has their idea in their head. And I think in a lot of ways it's shared. Of like, we all kind of, you
there
know,
are as many Star Citizens as there are donors to the Patreon. To paraphrase Gandhi.
Yeah, and so everybody has their idea, and so as long as it remains like, oh, this is in development, and you know, you like, everybody's able to project.
As long as they don't go in a direction, they're fine.
Exactly. As long as they don't put anything concretely down, everybody can be like, oh, okay, well, there's still, you know, the game that exists in my head is the one that I'm going to be playing eventually. The thing is, and this was like, and now this is, I guess, kind of old news, especially if you've been following the project, but Derek Smart, because he, I guess, is a partly a result of his fight with his publishers, like, is something of an expert on, like, a lot of, like, the legal angles to game development. And basically,
the Ron Hubbard of game design, holy shit.
Derek Smart? Or, you know, Chris Roberts, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Ron Hubbard of game design, yes, very much so. Holy shit, yeah. Anyway, yeah, the basically, there's like, for consumer protection law, and this was, the consumer protection law says basically, like, because there are angles of it that are recently developed that have to do with things like digital products and pre-orders. because that wasn't a concern, obviously, until very recently. And basically, there's a what they call a minimum viable product is like, you know, your contract is considered fulfilled when you deliver a minimum viable product. Doesn't have to be labeled the 1.0 version of whatever software. It's just like, you know, it has to meet certain benchmarks in order to be considered like, okay, now you've delivered. I actually managed to get my refund just a few months on Star Citizen after like pestering them a little bit.
Oh, you should have let it ride, you pussy.
No, it's like, well, I guess, come yeah, on. Maybe. You know, that's,
imagine
that's,
like saying I bought Bitcoin in 2013 and I just refunded that person. Come on.
Somehow, I don't think it would turn out, like, you know, Bitcoin crashes to $30,000. Everybody's like freaking out. And, you know,
yeah.
No, like, I don't think.
Oh, God. How could you not? You could have been part of a class action lawsuit that put a man.
Ruined, he's still gonna be in the class action lawsuit, dude.
I know, but he could have gotten a cut in the Empire.
Yeah, yeah, maybe that, that's true. Actually, you know, for fuck JPEGs of ships in a non-existent video game, like that could have been like way more of a payout. That's a good point.
No, but like, imagine he's gonna pay you a ship JPEGs.
Yeah,
you could have $12,000 of ship JPEGs.
Here, look, I paid you in kind. You know, we're settled now. Well, that's it. Okay, so that's the thing is they've actually, like, in terms of at least Derek Smart's analysis, which I trust, his legal analysis, basically they've checked all the legal boxes that they've required as far as, like basically everything from now on is just gravy. Legally speaking, they have delivered their minimum viable product, and so nobody has any grounds theoretically on which to sue them for non-delivery of the product because they've delivered the
except for I've kidnapped your children.
Well, right now there's the pitchforks and torches, you know, solution to this problem.
Do you remember when No Man's Sky came out and they
people were pissed, saying, man. Hey, I was so burned by this
release out saying we're hard at work.
Yeah.
We're pulling all night trying to fix it.
Yeah.
And somebody just drove by the studio in like Wales, wherever it was. I took a picture, all lights off. And gaming journalists considered this like a murder threat.
Of course. Because of course they did.
The level of like
when that finally
when the bubble pops.
Well, and that's the thing is like so I mean it keeps getting delayed because they keep doing increasingly desperate shit behind the scenes. Like this is what I realize, like I'm sure you're not getting this in the press releases, but basically they sold like huge chunks of the company off to like private investors in the Cayman Islands or something to get like enough operating because they were out of cash like in December 2019. And then they had to like essentially seek outside investment, and there's a whole all kinds of you know financial shenanigans behind the scenes, but eventually like they're going to have to release Squadron 42 probably first because that's what the investors are demanding, and it's going to be a disaster. Or if they don't do it, then basically the investors start taking over all of the company and all of the operations, and so it the clusterfuck is coming, like what Derek Smart calls what the extinction level event, like you know the asteroid supposedly you know crashed into Earth and ended the dinosaur, you know, extinguished the dinosaurs, like that kind of level of
when the Earth was flattened, right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Earth used to be a sphere, and then it was made into a flat disk by the asteroid. Yes. Exactly. Waiting for the crash to come. It'll come eventually. I mean, there's no doubt, you know, because like, this isn't going to I think one bit of clout I'm willing to risk, Star Citizen isn't going to just kind of peter out and then, you know, like it'll drip until it dries up and then there's not going to be any more news and then it'll go away quietly. Like that's so not going
to
happen.
I have a theory that you're going to see someone who's probably pretty smart and competent is going to see this play out in real time and it explode and wait for the, and then someone's going to buy all of the assets for pennies on the dollar, and you will get either a Star Citizen like sequel that's pretty good. Like I think the name, so there's never been a Star Citizen game, right? But the name is now worth something.
Yeah.
So I don't think Star Citizen ends with whatever this current Ponzi scheme is. I think Star Citizen 2 is going to be a decent game.
Could very well be. I mean, as long as, you know, the original development team doesn't have anything to do with it. Maybe the artists. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that was the other thing. It was like Chris Roberts kept, like, you know, enormous sums of, like, I don't want to lie, but I think it was like tens of millions of dollars between making a bespoke motion capture studio and designing animations that, as far as I know, are all junk. Like, it's not even usable with the current version of the engine, but they spent millions and millions of dollars doing extreme, you know, detailed motion capture on Mark Hamill and various other movie stars to get them, like, in game for cutscenes and stuff. And as far as I understand, it's definitely, like, rumored and is not 100% confirmed, but based on everything we know about their technological problems and the state of their engine and everything, like, all that motion capture work is basically incompatible with the rest of their, you know, engine stuff. So, nice. Yeah. It's just, like, it just goes on and on.
If you want to hear the propaganda line...
Yeah, please.
It's... I gave you a launcher. What more do you want? Every email I get is download the launcher. Download.
And what happens when you... Okay, I download the launcher. I install the game. I launch the game. And then what happens? And why should I be happy with that?
Well, that is the question, isn't it? You know? But that launcher looks real good, you know?
Oh, it's a great launcher. The best. We got the greatest launchers, don't we, folks?
Yeah.
You. Oh man.
What's the odds we get a religion spawned off this thing? Let's say dev team dies in some kind of, like, horrible accident, right? So it's this what could have been thing with this probably a few thousand people around the United States and the world. If these guys all, like, die or like in some kind of accident. If there's a plane crash that kills the dev team,
they'll be like, "Oh, it's still in development." You know, it's still in development.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, the amount of money. Also, I really do think, like, there is a mechanic, correct, that you can, like, sell your ship to another customer.
It's complicated, and they, like, it used to be. So that was actually part of my decision to get, because I, like, in with the original. Oh my god, this goes into so deep in this thing, but it's fine. I think it just, you know, I imagine our audience would appreciate this discussion. So part of the, like, economic model and part of the, like, you know, the revenue model was what he calls insurance, which is basically, like, because the whole idea that he's selling is in a way very similar to Elite Dangerous and which Elite has a similar thing, which is basically, like, you know, you need insurance on your ship, because if you don't have insurance and your ship blows up, then you're out, you know, it's done, it's destroyed. So, and you have to pay, you know, a deductible, which is a percentage of the thing, right? So one of the early draws for the Kickstarter, when it was, like, and I think even prior to Kickstarter, that he had some kind of non-Kickstarter crowdfunding thing, essentially free insurance for life on your ships, or at least on the hulls, not necessarily on any additional components. And then, like, at a certain point, that became, like, not, I don't know, they were getting rid of that, but that was always tied to the ship. And at a certain point, there was, like, a gray market in, like, because, you know, if you pre-order, you get certain benefits, and maybe, like, a, you know, free insurance for, like, a year or some period of time, or discounted, blah, blah, blah. But, like, there were perks related to this, but, like, you wouldn't get necessarily, or I think past a certain point, it wasn't possible to have free insurance for life for being a backer. So the free insurance for life ships, there was, like, a robust gray market around that. And then in particular, there was, like, because then he kept coming out with all these variants and all these other ships, and people had a certain amount of money in the pre-order, but they wanted to, like, maybe change.
But when I saw the carriers come out, I knew this is going to be hilarious.
Right. Yes. Exactly. That was when it all started going really downhill really fast.
Because imagine how unfun playing the playable carrier would be in, like, real life. Like, imagine a game where you're playing carrier commander. Like,
yeah, it's just not even, it doesn't even make sense. It's just like,
that's what, like, next to hospital ship.
Right, exactly. So So, I mean, it makes a certain amount of sense in, like, Eve, but this isn't Eve, right?
Because you're not, because in Eve, you also are playing, like, a fleet. You're not playing.
Right. But anyway, so he, I forget, I don't know all the details of this because it's just, it makes my eyes bleed. And I mainly just, at this point, I'm in it for the comedy value. But basically, he did something where, like, because previously, essentially, you could, quote, melt your ship and then basically take that same amount of money that you would put into it and just put it in another ship. Now it's like, basically, everything is tied to your account, and you have to, like, if you want to change something, you have to pay money to be able to pay more money to, like, change your ship or buy a new ship. It's just like you're literally paying money also, for the privilege of paying money.
Way, are you tracking that it's free to, it's now it's free to play?
Is it? I had lost sight of that. No, yes, I didn't know that.
That's how I got it. That's how I got the newsletter. Is I bought the free to play. There's no game, but
that's hilarious.
I said yes, I will play for the free to play game, and they started giving me emails.
Wow.
That's how I got the newsletter.
Wow. I might, you know, since we go
to... I'm currently a user. I didn't cuck. I didn't pay any money. But I'm a user.
Right. I think I'll have to install it, and, like, we could do, like, a roundup of at some future point of... yes. The Star Citizen Launcher and Elite Dangerous Odyssey.
StarCitizen.exe.
Look, you can, yeah, the game, you know, you can even, no, I mean, it's not fair. I mean, you know, you can even, there's a hangar, and you can maybe even get inside your spaceship for a few minutes before it crashes the desktop. I didn't necessarily want, I mean, it's fine, I didn't necessarily want to talk so much about them, but I think we hit pretty much all of the, like, I mean, yeah. we want to talk about X-Wing, we want to talk about Wing Commander,
well, I
want to talk about Free Space
about, yeah, this genre is that, as so it was in a really good spot in terms of until, like, say 2010,
yeah,
in terms of what the tech was and what the expectations were, and then the level of tech increased and expectations increased, but there's not, if you want to increase what a space sim is, you need a lot of power and some creativity. You can't really do any more than, like, the pre 2010 space sims did. You could Elite Dangerous, I think, is kind of added some procedural generation. It's really good, but the bones are very much the same. So I think these games kind of get caught in promising the world. No Man's Sky did the exact same, almost to a T. They just didn't.
Yep.
Do but a Ponzi scheme. They just released a bad game.
Right.
Which is, like, honestly, kind of a noble endeavor in a certain way. It's like,
I totally agree. And they ended up, you know, selling a bunch more copies too. Like, they kept with it, and
they polished it up a little bit. They gave us the notorious soy face origin picture. You know, so probably in 100 years, they'll probably be known for the soy face image picture they all took. more than the actual game, but...
I'm sure. Like, meme historians will go back, and here we can see one of the earliest examples of soy face.
Oh, yeah, and then... But Elite Dangerous, I've always wanted to go play... I was very excited for it. I kind of bought the hype with that one because it didn't seem as outlandish. That you could, you go to worlds and they'll be procedural generated. But it seemed like the actual, game wasn't quite there. But I think that's kind of like that's going to be the story of the genre going forward. There's going to be a lot of things promised. It's going to be all things to all people, and then you're going to get games that are kind of disappointing. I think Elite Dangerous only escaped it by not... There's never been really any press around Elite Dangerous.
No, they took a smart approach. They you know, they're like, look, for release, we want to hit these things, and it's a little bit, you know, I wouldn't say bare bones, just like cold and empty, but not... I mean, all the systems are in place. It was a solid framework.
And it kind of plays into the emptiness...
Yeah.
Bit, you know, like, they're, it's kind of, the game kind of embraces that.
Definitely. And then they just, they slowly added more systems and, you know, more things. And I saw an interesting, I still read PC Gamer. They've gotten woker and woker, and it's very, very sad. And I don't really know, but it's like, you know, it's a kind of general thing. They're, you know, just one of the only outlets that you know, until our guys do a kind of equivalent, that's, I find... typically, you know, at least I can browse the headlines. Anyway, they had an op-ed a while back that I I could see where they were coming from and probably agree. I haven't played the new expansion for Elite, but they were saying, you know, from someone who was playing an early, you know, pre-release version, that for the first time you now have human NPCs, and that made the game feel, the simulation feel less realistic, because like prior to that everything was very industrial, and you know there were no
the whole kind of conceit is that you are just like so far on the edge of space that you're the only human. You're just with automated systems.
Well, but and even when you're like in, you know, it's sort of like the human characters don't even matter, right? It's not really, you know, it's not even really relevant or part of the thing. But now that they're adding it, it's like, you know, it sort of breaks simulation, because it's very obviously a computer game, as opposed to like you could almost kind of squint and lose track of like, you know, it's just you're at a space station or whatever. You know what I mean? Which I totally get, and it sounds right, you know. So I don't know how it's going to play in that way in the long run, or what it'll mean. But I will say, you know, definitely big credit to the Frontier Developments for doing it right, and you know, being incremental and getting all your systems right and not biting off more than you can chew. And this speaks to something we've talked about a number of times, and I'm sure will come up again in the future, of like, you know, what is a video game, or what is a video game for, or what is the kind of core, you know, what is it doing as a work of art, or what is it trying to be? And I think there's all, you know, since the dawn of the computer age, there's been this kind of like fantasy or idea that, you know, we can create an infinite open-ended world that is full of possibilities that will be meaningful and interesting for players, kind of like you mentioned Ender's Game earlier, the game, not the like the space, you know, strategy game that Ender plays, but the like the computer game he plays, right?
Yeah, the ogre thing.
Whatever it is, yeah, like that is, I think, the exact like the Orson Scott Card is sort of playing into that fantasy that we all have of like, you know, it's because it's a completely open ended adventure game where you can kind of go anywhere and the computer just kind of spits out, you know, interesting stuff for you to do. The reality is that that's almost certainly with currently existing technology, that's not really possible. That's not something that you can create essentially infinite amounts of content. That's, you know, your procedural generation has come a long way, and both No Man's Sky and Elite Dangerous use it to great effect. But it's going to be boring. It's always going to feel kind of the same. Even if it spits out occasionally interesting stuff, it's never going to be as interesting as stuff that is hand designed. More importantly, the systems that, you know, there's always going to be a fine, because computer memory is a finite resource. Hard drive space is a finite resource. Processing power is a finite resource. And you're never going to get, you're never, ever, ever going to get, like, you know, an infinite number of systems. And you wouldn't want it to, because then that's just real life anyway, right? So, like, it's always a question of, like, what slice of reality are you going to approach, and how are you going to approach it, and what systems are you going to model, and what systems are you deliberately not going to model in the name of fun, because fun is obviously going to be important. Whatever, you know, whatever you find fun. We talked about space shuttle. I'd be curious to see like what, you know, but this, something can be very, very technical and still be fun, right? It's, or at least for some fun for a certain kind of person in a certain kind of mood. But yeah. And so like fundamentally, I think when, you know, the kind of, you know, do anything, be anywhere, end all be all kind of approach, it's just never going to work. It's never going to lead to good games. And, you know, you end up in this kind of mush of like the Ubisoft map painting simulator where you're just, you know, collecting icons, and like it just, you know, maybe you have individual bits of that that are good or fun or whatever, but it just doesn't work. It's kind of, I think it's a dead end for design. And that's, you know, we talked a little about the roguelike genre. I think that's one of the reasons for the return of difficulty in those kind of design elements, is because people have realized like, that kind of, you know, the open world thing is sort of played out, and there needs to be some, you know, like handmade content, whether kind of narratively based or not, is always going to be, you know, like procedural generation is best used sparingly. And, you know, Elite Dangerous does it well. No Man's Sky does it well. I haven't really played No Man's Sky. It was one of those things that like, I anticipated it would be not the greatest on release. I was rewarded for that. They've said it's the new version, you know, like the improvements they've made since are really great, and I'm sure that's true. Maybe worth a spin on sale or something, but yeah, end rant, I guess.
Oh, speaking of our guys making games, I do have one idea. I mean, it's kind of separate from the episode, but... Alright, so an RPG similar with Skyrim, you know, D&D always has like the power, you know, I Borch just made the joke that power word kill is the N-word in D&D. I want a game that makes you say into the mic any kind of like taboo words
for power
on a scale, right? And you can, but other players hear you say them. And if the more players hear you say the N-word,
the more power you get.
The more power you get, right?
Yes.
So you have to, and it's, so you do proximity like mics, you know. So you're
speech processing is at the point where like, you know, that stuff
we
can
call
be
it battle cry, right?
All right, I think that about wraps. Did you have any closing thoughts or anything?
Another system I want is when you log in, they have, you know, your nationality is part of it, right? So
like flags on pole.
Yeah, like flags on pole, right? So if you use a correct slur against this correct nationality, you get a multiplier. Right?
Perfect. Yeah.
That's almost as good as the breathalyzer. A lot of people talk about the idea of a breathalyzer shooter.
What's that?
You do a fast paced style shooter. And the peripheral is like, obviously the game you download, it's a, you know, for your PC or whatever, but the peripheral is a breathalyzer, and every server has a limited, like a limit to how sober you can legally play and be. So every player is equally drunk. In the fast-paced quake style shooter. I'm not the first one to think of that. That game's gonna be great.
Is it a real thing in development or just an idea?
No, but it's always been kind of like kicked around as to,
yeah, no, that would be funny for sure.
Get this product because, oh god, like, you know, that's always been one of the things is playing video games with parents. There's a lot of stories.
Time honored tradition.
I mean, there's no shortage of Counter Strike players doing fucking meth and shit.
I guess like the competitive ones.
That gets closer to competitive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, wait. I think that's good. We've kind of wrapped
up. Yeah, I think we've said enough about this.
Don't do math and play Counter Strike.
Do not do that.
It's not worth it. Counter Strike's not even that good if you really want to get into it.
That sounds. Talk about hot takes. we'll have to discuss that on a future episode. For now, I think that just about does it for this one. Yeah. So, again, hope you all enjoyed. And take care, everybody.
Dumb. Girls are dumb.